Welcome to the Southern Fried Ambition Podcast. In this episode, I sat down with Heath Lane, who is a local musician, a member of The Oath, and he has solo material as well. I've also collaborated with him on the Revelator project. If you want to hear more of his music, check out the show notes. But without further ado, this is episode 2 of Southern Fried Ambition with Heath Lane.
Floor, tallest building in downtown Little Greenville, South Carolina.
I didn't know if you wanted to, you know, triangulate your location.
Hey, you know, you got a lot of floors to search before you find me. And if I know you're coming,
well, you just said 11th floor, so they don't have to.
That doesn't mean I work on the 11th floor.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's true.
There's a conference room on just every floor.
Ooh, ha, ha, ha,
so I'm just saying.
This is just the one that we managed to get.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's it's a nice perk having your own conference room.
That's your beck and call.
Yeah, my beck and call.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with great power comes great conference rooms.
Great something. Yeah.
So, I'm gonna let you take the.
I have to take the lead.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where we're going.
Which it's path. All about you, man.
Oh wow, which path do we go down? There's so many things we could discuss here.
Let's see. I saw that you were interested in the open mic tonight. That's the last thing I saw on the Facebooks.
Yeah, that was one of the things that
I know you've done it a couple of times.
I've only done that one once. Yeah, okay. That's. And it was travesty, to say the least.
Yay!
Yay! it was one of those situations where, you know, a combination of bad circumstances and gear failure just sort of leads you to not really want to. It's like, I'm not going to make any extraneous effort to get back out there anytime soon, but I also realize that a lot of my problem. When I went out there last time, I kind of went out there and did a couple songs, and I was having issues with my acoustic electric going haywire, and I had some issues. So I sold a few pieces of gear and replaced it with a much more adequate piece of gear. And so I'm thinking, you know, I might head back out there.
Yeah.
Just for the proverbial kicks and grins.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't know, I went to elementary school with Heath. I'm sure nobody knew that. You're a, you know, local musician, you know, bouncing around cover bands since forever. Yeah. But you've been with the same one for a little while.
I've been with these guys I've been playing with the sort of semi-legendary Oath for about a year, 2 years almost now, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess so. It's been the first one I've been in where you haven't been, you know, riddled with drama or, you know, all the other stuff that comes with it. And it's been okay. But, you know, there's still, I have a deep-seated resentment that I have to relegate all my original material to pretty much internet only. And therefore, I've been trying to look for other outlets to be able to push that stuff a little bit. And
yeah.
I know you mentioned maybe heading out that way one night. I think I was sort of kicking around the idea at some point maybe we should get together.
Yeah, because also, for anyone who doesn't know, I'm in an internet-only band with Heath, which for the first couple albums was Heath, Brooks Callison, who's our bass player who's in Seattle, and a rotating drummer position. Brooks... after the second album, Brooks decided he wanted to pursue his own goals, and he left. And rather than trying to figure out the third wheel, basically handed off all of the instrumentation to Heath, who seemed more than happy to do it. So I let that happen.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you know, I've always seen myself as like the total package, right?
Yeah, okay.
No, it's one of those. It's one of those things. No, it's one of those things where you know you can do it, and it avoids you having to deal with the coordination and right. the other rigmarole that you have to go through. Anytime you add another human being to the equation, mm-hmm. there's going to be a failure point, and so you know it. You know, it's one of those things that, okay, well, we kind of had an idea what we were going to do, so why not just,
yeah,
you know.
Why not make it a more cohesive thing?
If you can call the first 23-track debacle cohesive, I don't, I mean, it flowed.
Oh, it's beautiful.
But it was all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so whereas this latest project is a little more, you know, which is also something I'm trying to do with my own stuff, which is trying to make it a little more cohesive within mm-hmm. itself so that it feels like it fits together with the next song on the, you know, on the album or whatever. So
yeah. And basically we started off the first couple of tracks we did, we pulled, and we're going to do a couple more, I believe. We pulled some of our older tracks off of other albums and did stripped down acoustic versions. And we've kind of kept that feel. It's a little more robust on the other tracks, but we've kept that feel, that kind of raw, stripped down feel to it for the other stuff.
Sort of back to where, you know, when I came first into wanting to be a musician, you know, I had a few influences, and people laugh when they hear, okay, the band that made you want to play guitar or be in a band was AC/DC because of the sort of power mm-hmm. element of it. But, you know, when it came to actually creating music, it was like when the Seattle grunge scene hit, you know, yeah. it's like, okay, well, there was a lot more diversity in songwriting. So I was able to take elements of, you know.
Well, and that Seattle grunge scene also kind of had that you can do this in your garage kind of feel to it, where it gave you an entry level.
Right. And some of the bands that are still kicking out there are the ones that are still what I consider to be the most productive, mm-hmm. and I say this because my latest batch of stuff is incredibly, I guess, sort of orbits the whole Foo Fighters okay. sort of thing because they, as far as I'm concerned,
because Dave Grohl is a musical cockroach and he will never go away.
Exactly, yes. and obviously he was there part of that big revolution
yes,
there.
Yes.
And so there is still a vibe there. There's still an energy there. And he's gone back even to trying different methods of recording and experimenting more and working with Butch Vig and some of these other guys who were there in the Big Bang, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so to me, it just makes sense to sort of, so when I listen to the music like that today, it still makes me feel the same way that stuff made me feel back in 91, 92.
Yeah.
And when I decided,
like, yeah, this is going to get me late.
You know, I never really. That's the bad thing. It's like I never. That never really.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who got into grunge with the thought of females being a draw. Those people went into hair metal.
I was going to say you get into a cheesy trio with pyrotechnics and light shows and all that crap, and then
you end up, you know, being Jackal.
But don't tell my wife. So anyway, but no, it's for me it was always like, you know, you want some degree of, and I know you feel this yourself, you want some degree of, I want to be respected for this thing that I can do
mm-hmm.
or that I'm passionate about. And so for me, it was like, and what I'm doing right now is I'm going back to a lot of the sounds and feel that got me into writing songs, not necessarily
right.
playing, you know, and I'm still going, and I mean, now I'm using some of my guitar tones and stuff. I'm still banging on my SG, my Gibson SG, and I'm through my Marshall and, you know, mm-hmm. getting my Angus Young sounds, but I'm writing like Dave Grohl.
Okay.
And I'm trying to be a little more song hook oriented than, like, say, a lot of stuff I hear people do today. Because that's one of the things that, and again, with the newest version of the project we're working on as well, that's sort of the same thing I'm trying to take. I'm pulling from Mad Season and Pearl Jam and, you know, to a lesser degree, some of the other, you know, I've never written quite like Alice in Chains or some of them. But
right. I can't do a 3- and 4-part harmony with myself like Alice in Chains does.
Well,
so it's okay.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, and see, I'm having done everything from bluegrass to metal. I've sort of.
Well, that was the last album, right?
Pretty much. I was going to say that pretty much. And me, I came up with, without theory, I never understood, and I still to this day don't understand music theory. I know how to write a song. I know what a song sounds like, and I know how to create a hook, but I can't tell you what key I'm really playing in. I can tell you what the dominant chord of the song is.
Yeah.
But I'm not, I don't, I've worried less about theory and virtuosity and worried more about what would the average listener?
As opposed to I came up, through piano classes, through band, and through that kind of direction into music. Whereas you came up as the kid messing around in the guitar shop, making the sounds that you wanted to make.
Yeah,
and you basically taught yourself.
For me, it was putting on a vinyl record and, trying to figure out a part, and when I screwed up, I would go pick the needle up and drag it. I mean, literally. I mean, people, even though we came up in the waning days of cassettes and I was still a vinyl kid, I had a lot of vinyl. So it was like, as a youth and as a teenager and as an adult, and, I would pop that needle back a little bit and listen to that part one more time, raise the needle up, try it, and go back down and do it again. And I'd repeat, lather, rinse, keep doing it.
Yeah.
And it would work. I tried to take a lesson. I think I walked out on it. It was not for me.
Yeah. It's just a different path to the end.
The difference is you can read music if you had to sit down. You could probably remember some of your,
Yeah, I mean, I could probably, in a couple of days figure out how to play something on a trombone just because it's been 20 years.
Right.
But as far as vocals go, I am not at all classically trained in vocals, so I can't necessarily translate. I know what this means on the paper, but I could play it on the piano and then sing it, but I can't look at that note and sing it.
I
don't have that instrument.
To me, sheet music has always been one of those things that, great if you can sight read, but it always looked like gibberish to me.
So
it's like, to me, it's, even as in my adulthood, I've developed more, the only thing I can say is it's a form of ADD, and I've noticed it has gotten worse over the years, and I just don't have the patience to deal with it.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, but it's like even guitar tablature, which is simplified for, folks.
Guitar players.
Yeah, for regular guitar. Because we are a simple
breed.
However, for me, it was always, I just want to hear it. If I can hear it, I can play it. And I learned 99% of the stuff that I play when I'm relegated to doing these cover band gigs and stuff like that, I learn it in the car coming to work.
Right.
I drive down the road. I visualize what I'm hearing in my head and where my hand's going to be. I can tell what the timbre of an open string sounds like. So I can tell you if it's a standard natural G chord or something, a big open E chord or something. I know what that sounds like. So, that for me.
So you can basically hear the tuning and off of that, where your fingers are going
to
go.
I mean, very rarely have to actually sit down and practice a song.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that would be a much harder to acquire and much more valuable skill than being able to just read it.
Harder, I'm not sure. It might be a form of savantism. But
there is that. Yeah.
But
harder for the average person, but, easier for, whatever you are.
Yeah. For musical savant. And that's the thing is, I'm so used to, and I've had the privilege of playing with, you remember Cameron that we...
Yeah.
He was another person who could learn that way. And so I've had the privilege of playing with people who can do that.
Yeah.
And he and I could show up to a gig, and if we could convince whatever drummer we're playing with at the time to kind of follow his lead, he could musically direct the whole thing, and we could literally improv a song we had never played before, but if we heard it on the way to the gig, we could work our way through it.
Right.
And you'd never know we've never played it before. Whereas, most of the folks I've ever played with, it's like, you know, you have to show up to the practice and teach the other guys how to play the song or something. Right. It's just like, to me, it was always like, guys, do your homework. You know? Yeah. It's like, and
not necessarily realizing that they can't do the homework the way you do, you know?
Right. Well, yeah. But you know what? There have been times, and there are some times that I'll have to figure out a certain part or, I'll give an example, some of John Frusciante's parts from the Chili Peppers. I've learned a few things of his, and I've had to go watch him do it because I'm like, I can't quite figure out what he was doing. So, that he's one of the rare cases where he's got such a unique, funky way of playing.
Exactly.
You just can't see that in your brain. Yeah. You know, he is what we call, you know, one of those very silent geniuses that he will never get the kind of,
we attribute everything to Flea and the guitarist needs some credit too.
Well, in that particular band's case, I mean, that their rhythm section has always been majorly tight. I mean, Chad Smith, even Jack
Will
Irons.
Ferrell,
Will Ferrell's evil twin. Yeah. But, you know, they have a killer rhythm section, and that can never be denied. But they always sounded the most like the Chili Peppers. Well, after Hillel died, they sounded like the Chili Peppers with John Frusciante.
Yeah, yeah.
No Chili Peppers since.
Right.
Or in between his tenure with them.
Yeah.
Has ever sounded the same. So, for me,
you know, you bring in Dave Navarro, and it's okay, but it's not the same. Yeah, it's very much not the same.
I'm not sure if it's okay.
it's more radio friendly.
Dave Navarro in Jane's Addiction is one thing. Dave Navarro in anything else is no.
Right.
It's like Chris Cornell. Soundgarden, yay. Audioslave, yay. Hey. Solo, forget it. Let's not. Even Temple of the Dog, yes. Okay, I can. Yeah.
So you just don't want him to be on his own.
I just don't like.
He needs babysitters.
Exactly. He needs handlers. Jerry Cantrell, Alice Chains, same thing. His solo stuff, very hard to follow. Does not have the hooks. Does not have the oomph of the Alice in Chains stuff. Put them together, everything's good.
Well, and it's like, you know, they have a vision for this project, and then they go off and do their own thing. And it's, I want to show my artistic side, and I'm not going to use that, what I learned from that project, you know?
Yeah.
So, and there is something said for wanting to have a different sound for your own stuff. But
when you get so experimental that it becomes hard to listen to, or I'm not allowed, I can't immerse myself in it because I'm too busy waiting for whatever screwed up change or time signature issue you're going to have. So,
When do we leave the first verse?
or where did that come from? It's one of those deals where I think over the years I've just sort of figured that I'm going to make it easier on myself. So I kind of focus in and phase into whatever I'm listening to. Boom, I figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I can show up to a gig tomorrow. If you give me a list of 10 songs, I can show up tomorrow and not have to rehearse with your group.
Yeah,
I mean that's always been one of the things that I've just been good at now.
And then that's led to you being seen as a hired gun at some points.
Yeah, and for whatever cheap whore thing that makes me. I'm going to say it doesn't give you the same emotional satisfaction as doing your thing your way, but. I mean, you see what the scene around here is like.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have, we know peers who moved to Athens and other musical meccas shortly after the heyday of the big explosion of the scenes from Raleigh and from Athens and from, you know, Seattle and stuff. And all of a sudden everybody splits off and goes all these directions. Well, there's not a scene there anymore because, the whole horizon has changed. And
right. Well, it's like the groundwork for the Seattle scene was started in 1985.
Right.
You know, and without that groundwork there, then the scene doesn't pop up in the early 90s.
Well, it's the same thing. Yeah. Look at Athens, same thing.
Yeah.
You had, how many years did B-52s plow around that area? And then
R.E.M. for that matter.
I was going to say, R.E.M. came very shortly after. And then you had some other groups that were a little more straddling genres like Driving and Crying and stuff like that. And you had a few others that were...
And the people who show up after the boom almost never almost never become anything.
Nothing ever. So
don't chase the boom. Create your boom.
Right, and that's the problem. And that.
But at this point, everybody has a local scene, and it's the curse of the internet is everyone can hear everything, and nobody hears anything.
Exactly. There is a scene, but there's not.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
and there's such thin margins at the record companies that they're not willing to invest in a scene.
Well,
so there's not an explosion.
The blessing and the curse of that is you don't need a record company, really.
Right.
But you have to have some means of promotion.
But you have to have a day job.
Right. You and if you're lucky, you have one, you know, where you have your conference room.
Yeah.
Conduct interviews.
Where you can do podcasts and such.
The thing that bothers me the most is that in this particular area, we do not have, I mean, we have original artists. Yes. They're few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you whittle those down from the ones who are jumping on whatever particular sound, be it in whatever form of gent metal. I just figured out what gent is.
Gentleman?
No. I thought that too. I thought that was some new hipster crap, you know.
Gent is
spelled D-J-E-N-T. And apparently it is an onomatopoeia to that, you know, that sound that metal guitars make.
Oh, okay. So crap.
It's basically... Well, John, let's be diplomatic here. It is the
metal.
It's the metal equivalent of planking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
just lay it out face first.
Yeah, exactly. And take it. Just lay there. I mean, to me, it's useless. But you know, there are original artists, and there aren't many that are really doing their own thing. A lot of them are chasing sort of whatever flavor of the month or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's unfortunate because I remember, you were.
I was away.
But before you left, I mean, when we were coming up right before high school ended or right after, you know, we saw this bloom of, like, say, I hate to bring up such a just stereotypical thing, but you had the, like, No Depression era of, like, the alt-country stuff, like, from Raleigh. Like, we had Uncle Tupelo, which split mm-hmm. up into Wilco and Sunvolt. And I had the pleasure of getting to open for fairly local. They actually were kind of based out of, you remember the fellow that owned Spinning Mule Records?
Yeah.
He was a member of Six String Drag, who was very much in the same vein as mm-hmm. Uncle Tupelo. I had the pleasure of being able to, you know, open with those guys and play with those guys a little bit. And that was an eye-opener. And that got me into all sorts of new things. And that's the reason for a long time there, I spent a lot of time in that particular scene.
Yeah.
There was an opportunity there.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that people were afraid of because it was too country for rock and roll, but too rock and roll for country. But it was more authentic than any of the stuff that was coming out at the
right.
time. Yeah. So it was like, it was real. But at the same time, there was only a small window of time there where people actually acted like they cared about it.
Right.
It's like, you know, there was probably a window of 5 or 6 years where, man, we were playing every week. I mean, we were playing in Greenville, we were playing in Clemson, we were mm-hmm. getting to go to Columbia, we were doing, and I mean, we were playing good gigs, and people gave a damn about what you were doing. It wasn't like, hey, play, you know, this Skynyrd song or some crap. You know, it's like you didn't have to go through that rigorous torture. But now it's not so much like that. You have a few venues around here that will allow you to slide an original song in here and there.
But most venues are bars full of drunk people, and they want to hear covers.
Absolutely. And that's where you end up getting relegated to just doing it just to keep your chops up, just to keep your fingers from going, you know, out of practice, keep your vocal cords stretched and all that. Now there are venues, there are very few and far between, and the bad thing about that is there's like sort of, you have like cliques of certain groups of folks who grip onto those dates tightly, and they keep those schedules loaded.
Mm-hmm.
So these places do not like to hire much outside of that.
Right.
And it's a little bit of a monopoly thing going on there, and it's.
But at the same time, the venue sees that these people that we let play here draw, and if we let somebody else in, they might not draw, and we might not make any money off a new band, you know?
Right. But that's where you do what we used to do, which is don't be afraid to have an opening act.
Mm-hmm.
you know, save your headliner one hour out of their 3 hour set or whatever. Let somebody else hop up there for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And give them a shot. See what they sound like. See how the people react. And unfortunately, a lot of folks are not willing to do that.
Yeah.
So you end up with...
Yeah, because they're afraid they'll lose their crowd.
Right.
In the middle of the opening act.
Or you have, and I hate to say it because this was brought up in an online forum the other day, and, mm-hmm. and I think you posted something yesterday or something that I actually liked.
Yeah.
It was the thing about the opening bands.
There's a UK bar that is now mandating that the opening bands stick around for the headliner.
Yep. And that should go both ways. Mm-hmm. And I've been in both situations where... been the opening act, and you're literally the only crowd there for these guys besides their girlfriends and the bar staff.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we've
had shown some love. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've also been on the other end of that where I've been in the headlining group and, you know, your opener just sort of, you know, either they stick around and root for you and give you a little bit of that, that support, or they walk out and then it's like, wow, really? You know, yeah. and it's
we just gave you a shot, and this is the thanks we get.
Or, you know, that's one of the things that I will never get over. And don't get me wrong, there are times that you have to split. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, man, I got to get up early for work. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's, if it's a weeknight, I don't expect somebody to, like when you go do open mic nights. You know,
you
go in there, you watch a couple of the people before you, you stick around for one or two after you, and then you got to traipse out of there. Well, you know, you do have a day job and adult responsibilities and all that bull crap. So, but yeah, I think that was the thing that I remember is, you know, we used to give people an opportunity and we used to ask the opportunity,
mm-hmm.
ask for the opportunity, excuse me. And nowadays, you kind of have these little cliques. They aren't really willing to talk to you. I won't name names, but there are a couple of other singer-songwriter types.
If you want to.
No, I'm going to keep it classy. Now, if you want to talk about some screwed-up business stuff and some people just shafting you, mm-hmm. I'll be willing to drop names all day long because I got some stories, but way too long for this podcast. We'll have to be in episode B. But there are some local... singer-songwriter types like myself who, you know, I've tried to reach out to numerous times. Say, hey, you know what? You're in pretty good at this place. Is there any way you get me a number or any way I can come maybe sit in, do like a mini set or something like that? Mm-hmm. I really would like to get my foot in the door there. And, you know, you just don't get a response.
Right.
But you get the invite next time they have a show there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
you want to come watch me, that's fine.
But right.
But if you want to participate in the experience.
Yeah, you can go stuff it. And that's one of the things that gets on my nerves to this day. It's like, you know, I remember a scene that was supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And it now it's very selectively supportive.
Yeah.
It's very political. And it's to the point where there have been a couple times I've taken breaks. Like, 2-3 years where I didn't gig at all. There was one time I was so disgusted with the way some things were handled that I didn't touch a guitar for over a year.
Yeah.
Just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I just had to put it down and walk away. And when you get something like that stripped out from under you, one of the few things in this world you can do pretty well and you don't want to do it.
It
breaks your heart.
Yeah. So. Yeah, because I don't understand people who don't have a creative outlet, who don't have something that they're working on, you know, whether it be woodworking or, you know, adding onto your house, whatever. So doing something with your hands or your voice or, you know, just doing something to make something.
Yeah.
I don't understand not doing that. But there are large groups of people that don't, you know, cosplaying, whatever you're into. Make a thing.
Yeah, and do your thing.
Yeah.
And that's because there are hobbies. I mean, you know, I'm an avid toy collector, science fiction toys and stuff. And I'm, you know, probably every bit as geeky as the rest of anybody out there. I mean, I am not ashamed of my geekdom.
Well, one of my earliest memories of Heath is playing Risk with him in the friggin' PE portable when we were there for some reason. I don't know why. I
the state of educational funding in South Carolina.
Yeah, we were like counting Campbell soup labels. And,
I believe so, yeah.
And during breaks, we played like 4-hour-long games of Risk. And yeah. I don't know why we were not required to be in a classroom for like 8 hours at a time, but, you know, whatever.
I was we turned out okay, I think.
Yeah, despite the education system, not because of it. Yeah.
But you know, it comes back down to, I have interests, I have passions, I have liked the video game occasionally and stuff like that. But you know, that's for me to escape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thing about, I think, with music, it's more of an outlet than people realize. I think, you know, there are a couple different ways of writing, and one is for entertainment and the other is, again, to express something.
Right.
And I think that what a lot of folks don't realize is that whether it's autobiographical or simply something based on an experience, there's some truth. And when you're actually writing stuff, it's not just about, well, it shouldn't be just about throwing words together.
Yeah, it's not about random stuff. You're actually throwing a part of yourself onto that page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, granted, there were times that I had worked with folks in the past, and again, one of the reasons that I took on so many different roles and learned different instruments and started doing vocals and stuff, because I was sort of dealing with, you know, anytime I was working with folks who were songwriting, it'd be like the same form, maybe in a different key, but the same song structure every time. Or,
right, yeah.
You know, you deal with somebody who was writing the same lyrics about the same subject or, you know, whatever, over and over again,
I know that guy.
I think everybody knows that guy. But, you know, it's like literally, it's like, geez, okay, we get it. You have a crush. Okay, can we move? I mean, it's like, you know, how about, let's write about something else. Let's write about the woes of having to, you know, bus tables at the seafood restaurant or some crap like that. So it's like, you know, that it kind of came out to me like, okay, I need to do this if I want to do it to make me happy. And for the most part, it doesn't. There's something to be said about when you get to a certain point and you get this, the right mix, and you get this, all the things that you hear in your head come together, and you can lay them down and mix them out. And I was like, wow, okay, that's what I heard in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand that. They don't understand that this is what I hear.
Yeah.
Going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't stop until I record it.
Right.
When I record it, it goes away, and then I have to relearn it if I ever want to perform it live.
Exactly, yeah. Usually I'm very good at keeping the lyrics and writing down the lyrics and keeping them where I can get to them. With Fish Heads, I don't know what I said in about a quarter of those songs. So I would have to figure out what the lyrics are in some of those mumbly parts.
We'll have to go through and like isolate the vocal. It's like, wait a minute, what was this about? Mashed potatoes?
Which is very much a possibility on that project. Because, there was some, We attacked the music with an earnestness, but the lyrics, not so much.
Well, that's
what it was.
Well, there was an underlying message there, but the tone and the presentation
was absurd.
Was a little more aloof.
Yeah,
and that was okay because it complemented.
Yes,
and I think that's the way you can do it. And it's like one of the songs that I'm thinking I'm probably going to pull out tonight is one I don't even think I've ever played. I'm going to have the lyrics in front of me because it's just too many of them, and it's one of those deals where, damn if I can remember exactly what they are. So I'm going to have to read them. I'm going to have to hope that I can time everything perfectly. And I hope I can keep the breath to be able to say it all in one sentence, you know?
Yeah.
It just happens that way. But I think what it comes down to is that I try to listen. And that's the reason I used to be a big fan of, like, say, the alt stations on, like, my satellite radio and everything. And I liked them, and I liked the idea of them, but then after a while, it's kind of like when I can't tell the difference between one artist and the other.
Yeah, yeah.
It starts getting to the point where, okay, I miss those days where you had all these artists from this area.
Yeah,
and they every single one of them sounded different.
Have their own unique sound. Yeah,
and I don't hear that anymore.
Right,
and I think I've complained about that before.
Well, I mean, at least even if each band didn't have their own unique sound, they were different groups of them emulating different groups.
Right. Well, I mean,
so it wasn't all homogenous.
Well, I was going to say, people don't realize how much, like, I'm just going to pick on Nirvana here for a second, but people don't realize how much they actually lifted from Black Sabbath and the Pixies.
Yeah.
Two totally freaking polar opposite types of bands.
But you've got Doom. But that's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how you develop a sound, is you pull from, I like this, I like this, yeah. I like this. What can I make with that? And you don't necessarily do it consciously.
Right. But it's that's how it happens. I like the art rocky quality of Frank Black stuff, but I want to throw a Tony Iommi big thundering Doom riff in there. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, yeah, there you go. You got it. And it worked. And that's the same thing I see. But see, I see, like, again, going back to the Foo Fighters, I see that sort of blended mentality, but I also see some weird stuff like Steely Dan type,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Stuff in there. So it's, and to me, that's kind of neat. I mean, even though I'm not crazy about some of the influences, I like the interpretation of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that I think a lot of folks miss. And I think that's when I started recording the latest group of stuff that I'm recording, which has been coinciding along with the stuff that I've been doing with you. And coincidentally, the Oath wants to do their original CD now, so it's like, okay, so I've got three projects
on top of projects, which is why I haven't been pushing hard on you.
But the cool thing is, I've been able to take things that I'm using over here and also apply them here and also apply them here and still have them sound completely different.
As long as we don't end up with a Pearl Jam Footsteps, Temple of the Dog, Times of Trouble thing where it is exactly the same instrumentation, just completely different vocals.
There's going to still be plenty of diversity.
Yeah.
And again, that's the reason, you know, when I went bought my new acoustic and all that stuff, I was like, okay, I'm buying this with the intent that this is going to help me re-inspire a little bit. And that's sort of what happened. I find myself a little more, and that's the reason, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, I'll kick my own self in gear a little bit.
Well, and you know, there's the thought process that everyone thinks that artists go and check into a studio for 3 weeks and create an album, and that's just not the reality anymore. At least with most, you know, if you're a major label type thing, then that might happen. But at the same time, if you're a major label, you have four people writing each song for you. You have a writing team for your songs, and you're lost in the creative process at this point.
Well, but, to me, that was always irresponsible anyway, because it's like I've had studio engineers and some that to this day still owe me money for time I never used that was paid for. But you know, that was always one of my work ethic. I would show up.
Yeah, if you're going in without everything prepared, you're wasting time.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, I was always the one take wonder. Now I might go and redo a lead break or have to do a vocal a couple times to get it where I wanted it. But most of the time, when it came down to laying down that fundamental, you know, riff and getting everything, I would go in there prepared, and I would want the band prepared. So when it was involving other people, you know, I'd say, okay, we're not going in there until we have this down. And and even when I do it now, I'm a lot less, I guess, a lot less stringent on myself because I own my own recording equipment. I don't have to be rushed. I'm not on the clock. I can do it at 2 a.m. I can do it, you know, as soon as I get home from work, whatever. And so I can do one part today, and I'll come back and do another tomorrow morning or 3 weeks from now. You know, it just depends. And that's sometimes it's better if I do it that way.
Yeah.
But I go in there with the one part figured out, at least. And I think that's the thing that folks forget, is that it does take preparedness, and you should, that's the keyword, should go in there with this idea pretty well constructed and smoothed out.
Well, it's like when I'm laying down vocals, I might do verses at one point and then choruses at another point. But more than likely, I'm going to do all the verses in one take, in one run, just because I can hear the slight change in timbre if I do it, you know, at another time. So I want to do all of my main verses in one single run.
That's exactly.
And I want to do my choruses in one single run.
Yeah.
And And that way, you know, if my voice is degrading, you know, as I'm going through the choruses, it's a cumulative thing and it's going through the choruses.
There's some,
and that kind of adds
there, yeah.
to it. Yeah. yeah. You know, it gets more gravelly as you go, as opposed to, well, the first verse is kind of gravelly. The second verse is
yeah.
something else. And it, you know, and it adds a consistency to the sound.
And I've done that before too, but that's exactly what I do. Right now, my latest technique has become record the verses, and if there's any, like if the choruses are a little louder or if it's going to be a totally different feel, I will do that. I'll record verse, skip to the next verse, skip to the next verse, and then I'll go back and do the choruses on a separate track.
Yeah, and if you do the choruses on a separate track, then you can apply freaking effects to just the choruses as opposed to having to and split things out and stuff like that.
And I've done a lot of that. Like, there are some songs that I'm recording right now that I've done. Like, I'll go in and I'll do sort of a slight delay effect on, like, the verse vocal. But then on the chorus vocal, I'll actually do a full-on doubled vocal to give it more oomph. And then there's, like, another song that I've used a megaphone effect, you know, to where it's, like, the verses are, like, all distorted. And then the choruses come in loud and clean, but the verses have this... where there's this air between notes, the verses are all... I immediately think of like Butthole Surfers or Nine Inch Nails or something where... or Ministry, where it's got this nice distorted vocal in there that just kind of jumps out and it scares you a little bit when you first hear it. And that's... I think that's kind of cool. So, yeah, I think using those techniques... And same thing with guitar. I've sort of bounced back and forth between... Sometimes I won't record all of one particular part with the same guitar or the same track. I'll... you know, like I'll play up to the chorus and then I'll kind of go back and blend it later in post-mix, you know, and I'll have a different guitar on top for chorus just to give it a different, you know, because the voice of the guitar, so to speak, is completely, you know, you can really abuse and take advantage of those different tones. So that's, and I do the same thing with drum parts too. I mean, I'll go back and add crash cymbals later because that way I can add them in a little bit more with a little bit more flair and do a little more adjusting,
a little more
volume.
Precision to it.
So when I do, you know, I just think that people need to be a little more, be a little more willing to experiment and think outside the box. But at the same time, go in prepared and go in there with your heart and go in there, you know, focused a little bit to where you want to come out of there and having said something.
Yeah,
and I think that's the biggest thing is. What gets me with a lot of music today, even, is I don't really hear a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on, but I'm not learning anything from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got occasionally, you'll have somebody like Muse or something that comes out with some interesting concepts and some different ways of presenting stuff.
The Doctor Who thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, you know, hey, that whole British dystopian thing, is, you know, I'm okay with that. That's its own monster. And I'm cool with that. Because they still remain one of the better bands, I think.
Well, and the most astounding thing about Muse is that they're a three-piece.
Right.
Yeah. Most people can't do that as a five-piece, but they make sounds with a three-piece that are just astounding.
Well, now, I know that lately here they've been using like an extra live synth player some, but still to think that much noise is coming out of those guys, it's pretty amazing. I mean, when you watch the bass player and he's got his... He's got his chaos pad or whatever, and he's doing the stuff, or he's using his Miso Kitara, which is the synth bass, and he's got the special double neck that's got the standard bass built into it, too.
Yeah.
So he can literally back and forth, and just amazes me to be able to, I mean, how much time goes into figuring that coordination out. I mean, I've got guitar synth pickups that I run into a processor that will emulate. I can do like pad sounds or organ sounds or piano. I can do any kind of sound you can imagine. But it takes some degree of skill to be able to apply that to a performance situation.
Yeah, a live performance where you have to jump between them. And
and even if you've got a tech over on the side holding the buttons down for you, that still takes a little bit of...
That tech has to be very well trained.
Exactly. Yeah. So sometimes it's a team effort. But one thing I've learned is that, you know, when it comes to recording and presenting my own material, I've sort of just decided, you know, for the time being, until I can find... folks that are, I guess, willing to dedicate, and that's my biggest problem, is finding folks who are willing to dedicate the right amount of time to learning the stuff, working on their parts. Like, I can't stand to play with another guitar player and us be playing the same part. It's like there's got to be some.
Yeah, there has to be some differentiation.
Because whether it's a different voicing, whether it's a different, you know, because if I look over, I'm playing this chord form and you're playing the exact same thing, one of us doesn't need to be there.
Right.
So, you know, it's like I want to earn my key. And that's the, one of the things that I do when I play in these covers groups and stuff like that is you'll see me playing a completely different position than the other guy most of the time.
Which is, yeah, what needs to happen.
But it adds this whole, and plus the fact that I've got like a completely different, I tend to have a very old school guitar tone, whereas, you know, some guys may use more distortion or gain, and some will scoop their mids and stuff to get that little bit heavier sound, but they
lose the warmth.
Right. Yeah. So I fatten it back up with the upper mids and the, you know, and the more woody sound, but I just play harder, and I play in these different forms, and it's like, bam, it just completely gives this wash of sound that's, you know, pretty impressive. So I say you got to do that to earn your keep, you know, and that's one of the things is like it's been hard to find folks that will commit to learning the material or working on it. And, you know, and again, the lack of venues. So there are a lot of factors that come into play that keep you from being able to really do what you want to do.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be having to work a day job.
Right.
But, you know, again, the internet being a curse and a blessing, you're out there.
Yeah,
people get to hear you. Hopefully, you get a couple people who repost your post and you know, or name drop your site or something, and you know, you might get a hit here and there, and you hope that, you know, at some point somebody is going to hear it and, you know, have something nice to say.
Yeah, and goes back to your back catalog and goes, "Hey, yeah, I want to buy all this stuff." Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what you hope for.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what I've kind of done is I've started whittling down. On like my Reverb Nation page, I've actually whittled down a lot of my stuff because what I'm planning on doing is sort of, as I get ready to drop this new batch of stuff, I'm going to kind of make it be its own thing.
Yeah.
And I want it to stand on its own, and I want to see what, you know, and so I'm going to like temporarily deactivate everything else and just kind of have that be the focus and see how it sounds as an album, you know, and see how people feel. Because I do feel like it's more consistent. It's going to be... And I've already had people tell me that they have heard the little teaser track that I released that, you know, okay, yeah, there's a lot of Dave Grohl in there. There's some, there's definitely some Bob Mould in there. I take that as a huge compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Bob Mould, to me, is one of those guys that just never got the kind of acclaim he should have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of compliment I love hearing. I don't want to hear how badass something it is. I don't want to hear... adjectives. I want to hear what it made you think of.
Yeah.
And when somebody says, "Hey, I heard some Dave Grohl in there. I heard some Bob Mould in there." I'm like, "Okay, cool. Then I mission accomplished." And I'm like, "I'm okay with that.
I just want to hear something. You know, give any feedback. Any feedback is better than no feedback."
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
And sometimes that's the key, is generating interest and making people want. But again, we've discussed this in the past as well. People have to want to hear something new, and they want to have they have to want to support art for what it is.
Right.
And instead of saying, "Well, I didn't hear this on fill in the blank radio station.
Yeah.
I didn't hear this. This wasn't spoon fed to me, prepackaged."
But really, at this point, if you're making art for anybody other than yourself, you're selling it short.
Right.
Because for the most part, nobody's ever going to hear it.
Well, that's the thing.
Just make what you want
to
make.
It's unfortunate but true. I mean, you have to just hope that some people will listen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
You just kind of push it out there and say, "Hey, I made a thing. And, you know, you might want to listen to it."
Well,
maybe.
You know, I wasn't blessed, John, with the money or the opportunity to be able to drop everything in my youth.
Right.
I know folks who did and squandered it away and came running back to little old South Carolina when everything kind of...
Well, your youth when you have no responsibilities is the time to do it.
Right.
But at the same time, the youth, when you have no responsibilities, is when you don't know what the fuck to do with it.
Exactly. Well, that was the key word, is don't know what the fuck to do with it. Because here's my thing. You know, I've worked steady. I've only not had a job for about a week since I was 15 years old.
Yep.
So I never didn't have responsibilities.
Right.
I never didn't have a bill to pay. Yeah. I never didn't have a car payment or something else. Mm-hmm. So I never had the opportunity to just say, oh, well, I'm just going to go on a self-promotion tour. I'm just going to do this and I'm right. going to do that. Yeah. I never had that opportunity. And I wasn't that fortunate. Yeah. So, and I'm not going to sit there and lie to you and say that I didn't spend a good many years resentful of people who actually were able to do that.
Right.
Because I was bitter. Mm-hmm. I was hateful. Cause I'm like, you lucky bastards. I'm
and,
like,
and then you fucked it up.
Yeah. You fucked it up. I was like, what kind of, you know, and there have been a couple of opportunities. If I could have stood being in the same room with people for longer than I could have taken advantage of a couple opportunities, which could have at the very least got me on an independent label or something. But I got to the point where I guess maybe principle and pride kicked in and I was like, I was not willing to mm-hmm. go through certain things. Yep. So I sort of forfeited that myself, for better or worse. Morally, I feel okay with it, but at the same time, I kind of, damn it, you know,
I mean, you don't want to give up yourself as a person to create yourself as an artist.
Right. Because then you're not creating anything.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, you can't pre-package yourself. So yeah, I think though at this point I've sort of come to peace with those follies and missteps, and I've kind of come to accept the fact that going forward we can only try to do what we feel we need to do to make ourselves to give ourselves satisfaction. And hope that somebody else will gather some satisfaction out of that as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do wish at times that I would have had the opportunity to go just flippantly take off and go on tour. Or just go join up with a group that was doing it and not have to worry about, you know, the responsibilities of home.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you've spent, you know, the last half of your teen years and, you know, beyond as an adult, you sort of have to accept that too. And you look at mm-hmm. what you got as a result of that. So you're thankful for what you have and what you have accomplished. But, I also used to have this mentality when I was, 18, 19 years old that, oh, when you get to X age, if you don't do anything with it, you quit.
Yeah.
As I got closer to those benchmark ages, 25, 30, 35. So it's like once you get closer to those ages, you sort of think, okay, well, maybe I can push that back a little bit and not worry so much about, I mean, I look at guys like R.L. Burnside and stuff like that who didn't get, you know, any kind of acclaim till much later in life.
Right.
And it's like, what am I worried about?
It's like I'm trying for the Emily Dickinson effect.
There you go.
Yeah.
Completely ignored during life, but posthumously, you know, revered as one of the greats. My stuff's
going to be huge in 100 years.
So, I think that's the thing to keep in mind. It's like just do it thinking that, well, in 10 years from now, somebody's going to hear it and something's going to, you know, something's going to click.
Yeah. And if you can affect one or two other people, then you've done something artistic.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I picked some of the songs I picked for my latest batch of solo stuff is because there's one song in particular that I actually wrote 20 years ago, mm-hmm. a little over 20 years ago. It has taken on I didn't ever play it after I left that particular band, and I never really thought about it until a few years ago. I dug out some lyrics and tried to reconnect with one of my old bandmates, and I was like, well, we were going to like kind of reimagine this. And mm-hmm. that was kind of when I was going through my discovery of Sugar and Husker Du and the Bob Mould stuff. So I was like, well, what if we did this, but in less of a chugga chugga punk rock kind of way and more of a, you know, big open chord, you know, like that kind of, I don't want to say pop punk or whatever, but, you know, right, just sort of like nice and jangly, but at the same time, not like, pretentious. So I hear that word when people jangle pop or jangle.
Yeah.
I immediately think of the incredible amount of pretension people who usually use that word, carry.
But
I thought about it, and I was like, well, what if we did this? And for lack of a better way of putting it, make it a little more adult and make it a little more contemporary, but still alternative sounding. Mm-hmm. And still, and I got to screwing around with it. And I'm like, okay, I actually like this better. It's the same tempo cut in half as far as mm-hmm. beats, and it might not be that much cut in half, but it's just a different feel. And instead of this just like pummeling driving thing, it's more of a like kind of a swing, kind of a flow. Mm-hmm. And I'm like okay with that. And but I've also rearranged pre-choruses, and it's like it went from being one structure to two long verses, two choruses, and a break in the middle, but not anything. You know, it's like it's completely different than what it used to.
Yeah.
And then for shits and giggles, I had to go throw in the the harmony guitar lead part and stuff like that. So I've completely turned this song around, and I'm probably going to catch some backlash for redoing it.
Whatever.
But because that was one of those few songs, you're talking about stuff that people remember. That was one of the only songs that I think I ever wrote that during that stint and mm-hmm. during that little when I was kind of doing like the ones pre-Green Day to discover, and I'm using the fingers for those who can't see, just to discover punk rock, because if you'll recall, you know, I used to get picked on for liking the Sex Pistols and the Misfits and stuff like that, you know, and it's like, because who are they, you know, those are old bands or what, you know, it's like
yes
yeah. So it's like I reached back and I was like, but back then we were like one of the punk bands before punk was cool. And by the time it got cool again, we had already moved on to something else. And it's like, damn it, I always do that. And so
you laid the groundwork for Green Day's resurgence.
Absolutely. I was on top of that.
In Greenville, South Carolina,
50% more influential than Billy Joe Armstrong. I'm just saying that, you know, we didn't have any foresight. It just happened to be dumb luck.
Yeah.
But it was not appreciated then either.
Right.
It's like we didn't get anything out of it. I mean, but we did have a handful of pretty righteous fans that were very, it was humbling. And there were two songs in particular, that one that I'm talking about in particular, though, that was even more so, that I'd have people come up and say, man, I related to that. That's me. I've been there.
Awesome.
And I'm cool with that. And mm-hmm. that meant something to me.
Yeah.
So that later when I discovered the lyrics, I was like, and I discovered an old crappy demo we recorded, I'm like, you know, I can see where that song might have been sort of poignant for folks, and I'm going to redo it. And so I started redoing it, and then it's like, wow, okay, I like this way better.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of going full circle. And that's what I think is important, is maybe that's the magic touch. To go back to where you were when it was still a new fire.
Yeah.
You know, when you first got the spark, when mm-hmm. the smoke started happening and, you know, shit started really rolling. And that's sort of what I've done. I've decided to go back to where it made me happiest. But this time, maybe not make so many mistakes.
So. And we're running up on time, and I think that's a good place to leave off.
Coming full circle, baby.
And there we go. And I think we could do a whole another hour with that.
Absolutely, because we still haven't touched on
Star Wars.
We haven't touched, and we purposely kept this apolitical.
We'll do one after the election.
I was going to say let's definitely do one after the election, and I'm sure we'll mix some religious stuff in there too, because I'm sure we could piss off a few people there. I think at some point we ought to touch base on maybe let me do you.
No,
not like that. Get your mind out of the gutter, man. Yeah, the beard's way too bushy for my taste. But I'm just saying, you know, maybe it'd be a good idea for you to
have the red light staring
to lay it down. You know what I'm saying?
Turn the mic around on me.
I'll get the little desk lamp and grill the hell out. I think that'd be great, and I want to make sure that. And I want you and I to get together soon here and maybe look at doing a couple of our tunes and maybe get you out to this open mic shit.
Yeah. Just do a...
Because
we've got some stripped down acoustics.
What the hell, man?
Try to actually get a bit of a following.
You know, it'll be bizarre. It'll be like Tenacious D, man. I mean, I'm just saying. So
Without the tenacity.
But the biggest D you ever saw in your life.
Somebody will bring that. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I guess if anybody's interested in checking anything out from me, you can catch me. Don't bother with Twitter because I've touched Twitter about once every 6 months. And that's usually to complain about something.
The only thing I do on Twitter is what auto-populates to Twitter.
Exactly. But you can catch me. You can Facebook me. Best place is hit my artist page, which is just facebook.com/HeathLaneMusic, just like it sounds. And I'm on Reverb Nation, too. Just ReverbNation.com/HeathLane and all one word. Those are the best places to find me at this point, and I'll link up anywhere if I decide to post my album anywhere else, SoundCloud or CD Baby or anything like that. And I hope that somebody will check it out and hit the like button. And I'm always dropping little notes about the Revelator project and about the Oath and everything else. So it's a good little circular way to keep up with everything.
Yeah, and if you listen to any of my podcasts, the intro music is always a Revelator song that I have poached and am using.
I like the one you used for this one, actually. I think that's one of my favorite riffs that we did.
Yeah, the On Deaf Ears. I love that song. And you can catch any of the Revelator stuff. It's Revelator on Spotify, YouTube, any number of places. R3, V3, L8R on Twitter. And we also have a Facebook page for Revelator. I'm not sure what the at is on that.
You can link to it on my damn site. That's what damn sure.
But we're out there and we're on every freaking music service possible. Bandcamp, iTunes, whatever. And so I'll get you next time.
This has been a Southern Geek Podcast.